This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is playwright, actor, and screenwriter Wallace Shawn. Shawn was a little-known, controversial playwright when he won a national following with his 1981 film, My Dinner with Andre. He co-wrote and co-starred in the film with avant-garde theater director Andre Gregory. Almost the entire movie is set at a restaurant dinner table where Shawn and Gregory, who play themselves, debate about theater and the meaning of life. Gregory describes why he left the theater to travel around the world in search of mystical revelations and a greater reality than theater could offer. Shawn argues that the cigar store on the corner has as much reality as Mount Everest, and the exotic is no more profound than the ordinary. Pauline Kael described the film as the search beyond theater turned into theater. Before the success of My Dinner with Andre, Shawn had trouble supporting himself. His life as a starving artist contrasted with the comforts of his privileged upbringing as the son of New Yorker editor William Shawn. In the last few years, Wally Shawn's movie acting has raised his income and recognition level. He's appeared in several films, including Manhattan, Starting Over, All That Jazz, Crackers, and Hotel New Hampshire. Shawn continues to write plays. Joseph Papp produced his new play, Aunt Den and Lemon, which is published by the Grove Press. Wally Shawn wants his plays to be shocking and confrontational, but most people know him from his film, My Dinner with Andre, which showed a withdrawn, benign side of him. When I spoke with Shawn, he warned me that he's not really like the character he plays in that film.
In order to make the movie an interesting piece and something that people could stand to watch for 2 hours, obviously we had to create a conflict between the two characters. And seeing as I was the person who constructed the script, you might say, I had to figure out how to distort us in order to make us into two people who would come into conflict and whose resolution would be somewhat, you'd feel a suspense about what would happen. So I made myself into a sort of super terrified little homebody, and everything that I have tried to get away from in myself in terms of being overly cautious in life, I put into the character. So I was very harmless and in a way rather likable because I was harmless. And actually, all of the characteristics that I emphasized in that character of myself were all the things that I hoped I would sort of go beyond by doing the movie. But still, the character I created was kind of appealing. And an awful lot of people have met me and been somewhat disappointed.
Were you warned when you were writing My Dinner with Andre that nobody would either produce or go to see a movie that was almost entirely set in a restaurant at a dinner table with two people talking?
I had never really had a successful project. So the idea that this one would not be successful was not, terribly upsetting.
You had to play yourself in the movie. Was that hard to do? You'd already acted in other roles in films, but you never played a slightly fictionalized version of yourself before. Was it hard to learn the lines that you'd already actually said in real life, more or less, and to play yourself, but not quite yourself, a little bit different than yourself?
Well, our director, Louis Malle, encouraged us to forget that it had anything to do with us, because I think he found that it was just unbelievably boring if we did what we would really do if Andre and I were having dinner together. And so Louis basically had to convince me that it should be played with a little more feeling shown than would be shown in life, and yet that it would look quite lifelike. And in fact, we rehearsed for a few months on video so that he could show that he was right about this point and others, which he always was.
One of the kind of running themes in the conversation that you're having with Andre Gregory in it is whether you have to actually leave the theater to experience the kind of experience that theater hopes to provide. And he left the theater in search of more exotic experiences like rebirth ceremonies and studying with mystics in in faraway places and things like that. And you were arguing that, and he argued that to experience a real decapitation in theater, you should actually pass around a decapitated head from a morgue so the audience really experiences firsthand what that's like. And you were arguing that all of that is unnecessary. Now, I think that the film, in its own way, proves that you're right, because here it is just a conversation with two people, where audiences, for the most part, walked away feeling that something quite remarkable had happened, and there were no decapitated heads getting passed through the audience. There was nothing really exotic happening. It was just basically like theater, except that it was in the movies. Do you think that in that sense, that the movie kind of proves the points that you were making, that you don't need that kind of exoticism in the theater to reach people?
Well, it is quite convincing, although I myself tend to hold the opposite view. My own plays are a little bit closer to passing around the real head. My Dinner with Andre, in that sense, is kind of an exception in my work.
How are your plays like passing around the head?
Well, I suppose I just take it for granted in a certain way that plays should be enormously upsetting to people, or it isn't even worth writing them. Now, I don't know why. I've always sort of, I seem to have assumed that for a long time. When I'm writing, if I've written a page that really agitates me so that it makes me just sick, I sort of think, oh, well, this is a good day's work. But I think that theater right now tends to be so fantastically cozy and comfortable padded cell or something that it just goes against my grain not to be terribly abrasive and shake people by the lapels.
Now, people come to the theater in a way. They spend their hard-earned money for a night out.
Right.
And frequently go to the theater to get away from those things that they're forced to confront every day.
Right.
And if they go to one of your plays, you're going to confront them with things that they don't want to confront. So do audiences ever get angry if they're not prepared for that kind of experience?
Yes, and I understand that. I feel, on the conscious level, that I have absolutely no desire to agitate the people who really are just tired and want a little diversion and have paid money to have a pleasant experience that will soothe them before they go to bed.
Are there scenes or lines in any of your plays where you know that this is the part where everybody who doesn't belong walks out?
Well, obviously, when a play runs for a little while, you do notice certain patterns. Both in Our Late Night and Marie and Bruce, there were certain places where many people would leave.
What were those places?
The beginning of Marie and Bruce is very abrasive. And, at the beginning, you know, we would lose, we used to lose 35 people a night just in the first 5 minutes of the play. I had the impulse and followed it on a couple of occasions to go up to people in the lobby before the play and to go up to them and say, you know, you're not going to like this, and I don't think you should go to it. But actually, you can't do that, because the reality is you simply can't tell by someone's appearance whether they're going to like the play.
My guest is Wallace Shawn. The plays that you write are so different. I'm just thinking, you know, knowing that your father is William Shawn, who edits The New Yorker, that your plays are just the opposite in their confrontational style and in their use of, you know, frequently obscene language. They're just the opposite of the polish and refinement and control that you expect from The New Yorker. And I just wonder if you think that there's any conscious or unconscious reason why your style is so divergent from The New Yorker style.
Well, I suppose there must be some connection, but I really wouldn't know quite how to go about describing it. I mean, It's true that the New Yorker doesn't go in for describing sex very explicitly, or there are certain things that they just don't write about. Of course, to me, my writing is actually quite refined, but it just happens to deal with some hot subjects. And I sort of would trace the influence more the other way and say, well, I mean, this, it is kind of obscene in certain passages, but it's also very grammatical and is also very sort of refined in certain ways.
When you temporarily left theater to do the screenplay and then act in My Dinner with Andre, was that an attempt on your part to like get away from the theater for a while? Were you wanting to get out? Were you disappointed with or maybe even disgusted with the theater at that time?
I really only have written sort of one play every 4 years anyway. That's just all that I have to say. I've basically had a fairly uncomfortable relation with theater. I don't think I fit in terribly well. I mean, my plays have basically been done in New York, and people across the country have generally not wanted to do them. So it's not that I dropped out exactly. It's just a limited interest in my work.
I guess it was in part because your plays weren't paying a lot of money that you started acting in movies. Your first movie role was in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Did you get along well with Woody Allen? Did you feel like you shared any common sensibility with him?
Well, we only met for 45 minutes. I was just in one scene. So I wouldn't say that we have a deep, lasting relationship. But I don't know what he thinks about me, but I feel totally indebted to him, really. I mean, certainly My Dinner with Andre, it just wouldn't have really quite... I just don't think one would have thought of doing it, really, without his influence.
Where does he fit into that?
He's expanded one's ideas of what can go into a movie. I admire him just enormously.
Do you think casting directors have you in mind for a certain type of character at this point, since you're becoming better known?
Unfortunately, I think so, yes.
You know, one of the things that bothers me about movies is that unless you're a kind of standardly handsome type person, you'll never get a romantic lead. and you're never even allowed to be sexual unless you fit the kind of current face of what's good looking.
I'm afraid this is brutally true. I mean to say it shifts and expands a little bit, but you know, basically that's true, and you can become quite concerned about it after a while, because you can begin to think, gosh, am I really so monstrous, so grotesque that no one can imagine me in a romantic relationship with another human being? Am I such a horrifying monstrosity as that? You can become sort of agitated about it, because if you're cast repeatedly in the same roles, or you're not cast in the ones that you think you should be cast, you begin to think, well, do the people really see me this way? Is this what I really am, or whatever?
Are there roles that you turn down?
Yeah. Mainly, I turn down things that offend me or that I object to from a moral point of view. There are certain things that are obvious. This movie makes fun of gay people, reinforces stereotypes about black people, encourages an audience to enjoy violence. There are certain obvious things. But then I also turn down things if they're just too stupid, if they're so idiotic that you sort of feel, well, this is destroying people's minds because it's so idiotic. It's just so stupid. And also, I turn down certain things where the little guy, the people listening to this don't know, I myself happen to be a little person, and there's quite a cliche in films that the little guy gets bullied, beaten up, thrown down the stairs, kicked, lifted up by the big guy or whatever, and smacked around. This is considered funny. And it's quite amazing how many scripts you get as a short actor in which the short guy is beaten up or whatever. Now, that's bullying, and the audience is encouraged to find it funny. So I tend to turn those down.
You know, it's also funny, too, if we're in the short stereotype in movies, the short character is sometimes, you know, not the kind of sexual, at the sexual center of the movie. Yet what really interests me is one of the great ironies is that, like, in your own plays, you really deal with sexuality in your plays. It's a kind of central issue in several of the plays that you've written. So it's just really hysterical, you know, to to think of ironies of that, about how people are given or not given roles according to the most stereotypical views. You know, it's like the fat people get certain roles in movies, and the tall people get certain roles, and the bald people get certain roles. And
if you're short and bald, it's a disaster.
My guest is Wally Shawn. Is the money that you're making from acting changing the way that you're living, changing your lifestyle or your values in any way?
The dangerous thing about money is that you truly don't notice any change. You don't really notice that you're not worrying about money. You're just not worrying about it. In other words, I will just step into a taxi to go somewhere. And 8 years ago, I would have been thinking, I can't afford this. I'll have to take a subway or whatever. And now I would just step into the taxi, I suppose, and I wouldn't think about it. And I wouldn't sort of think, gosh, I'm really leading quite a fancy life now. I'm taking this taxi.
You had to work for a while as a Xerox operator and a shipping clerk in order to make money to support yourself while you were writing plays. And what really shocked me is I was looking up, I think it was the contemporary theater biographies, and it says in it, under your entry, you know, 19 blah, blah, blah through blah, 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 Xerox operator, and it names the name of the company, and then it names the company that you did shipping for. And I figured, did he want this in? Did he ask that this be included in his biography and contemporary theater bios? So, did you?
Well, they asked what your profession was, I suppose. And I mean, in a certain way, there's a certain kind of not necessarily very attractive bravado about this, because the reality is that I have, come from an what you might call an upper class background, and it's been by my own choice that I have done these things that have superficially made me not seem to be a member of the ruling class.
You know, that reminds me of one of the opening scenes in My Dinner with Andre, when you walk into a very expensive restaurant that Andre Gregory has chosen for you to meet at. And you come in wearing a slightly rumpled trench coat, and you're not dressed up or anything, and you look like you're feeling very out of place in this restaurant, where Andre breezes in and he's just wearing a sweater, but it doesn't matter, he's casually dressed because he's at home in this place of expense and elegance because he knows how to behave in it. You know, he's just like one of them, even though he lives separate from it. And really, though, you grew up in a background where you could have been very at home in that. I mean, have you purposely tried to disassociate yourself from coming from, I guess, an upper middle class background?
From the time I was 13, I have always felt uncomfortable with the upper middle class world. I never felt that I was a part of it or wanted to be a part of it. It was in My Dinner with Andre that was sort of a coming out for me, because in the movie I admit that I came from a fancy background and don't. I mean, that's one of the things I like about the movie, is that it's a portrait of the dilettante children of that class in a certain way, if you want to look at it that way. You can look at the whole thing as a social satire. And that's why it's set in a fancy restaurant. And that's why we have the waiter who is actually working while we're philosophizing and so on. And I think for both Andre and me, it took a certain nerve to, instead of hiding from that, as I think we both always had, to sort of admit that.
What's embarrassing about it?
Well, being a member of the ruling class of the United States of America is sort of extremely awkward position to be in, and one doesn't want to see oneself that way. It's ultimately you don't particularly want to be the slave master holding the whip. You don't want to think, well, those peasants who are working the sugarcane fields for 10 cents a day in South America are working for me. You don't sort of want to feel that if you happen to think that the world shouldn't be organized in that way.
Your new play, Aunt Anne and Lemon, is concerned with morality and, in a way, with the temptation to abandon morality, to give in to certain temptations and to move away from your own ethics. Why is this a concern to you? Has anything happened to you recently that you've experienced or seen that has made this a really central issue?
Well, this is always the hot issue, I think, in every period. But it's a little easier to see things now, I think, in the Reagan period, because they're riding very high now on a philosophy that says, basically, we're on top. We like being on top. It's quite fun. If other people stand in our way, we'll just trample on them. Even the trampling process is somewhat enjoyable. So it does make you think about, I'm not sure I go along with these people. And what is it that I believe?
When you set up the characters in the play, the audience doesn't really have any clues that this is what these characters are like. And, you know, you always identify with characters, especially the main character of any play, the narrator, the person who's your guide through all the action and the dialogue, and you feel kind of betrayed, you know, when you realize that they've, like, lost their moral center. Is that part of what you're trying to do, is take us along, and then suddenly we realize we're identifying with somebody, or we're handing ourselves over to someone who's not what we thought they were?
Well, yes, because I have the terrible feeling that we're not necessarily what we think we are. I think that there's a little fascist inside all of us. So I think the play presents attractive characters who have a certain amount of charm and who are intelligent, but who represent a certain part of ourselves, but one that we have to be very careful with. And I think the play is written in a sort of strange way, because you're sort of left alone with the characters. The author kind of disappears.
What do you mean by that?
Usually in a play, the author is sort of in charge in a certain way, and you know very clearly what you're supposed to think about each character and what you're supposed to feel about them. And in a certain way in plays, the bad guys tend to lose and the good guys tend to win in one way or another. I mean to say, maybe the hero is being dragged off to jail at the end, but he says something incredibly heroic so that he may be going off to the jail, but his message triumphs in the play's terms. In this play, I thought it would be more frightening to sort of just introduce the characters and then sort of leave the room. In other words, that it's up to the audience to answer them or to deal with them. I'm not telling the audience what I think of them or what the audience is supposed to think of them. They will perhaps be inspired to think up an answer to the things that are being said to them.
I'm speaking with playwright, actor, and screenwriter Wally Shawn. Do you go to the theater much? I think of myself as really liking theater, and most of the time when I go, I'm bored stiff, and I leave wondering why I spend so much time there, and I'm frustrated, so I go less than I used to. And I wonder if you have experiences like that as a theater goer.
Well, I enjoy watching actors act very much, so there's always that. And in a certain way, it's equally interesting to watch an actor acting in something bad as it is to watch them acting in something good. So, and there's something, about that that is always sort of moving to watch the actor. There are a lot of other things in the world that are more important to me than going to the theater usually is. You know, in 1 hour in a museum, I would have 10 times as many experiences that mean something to me personally and that I find important than I would have in an awful lot of evenings at the theater. But I think now, I don't know, that every now and then there are things that happen in theater that are terribly exciting to me.
Well, I wish you the best with your play, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us about it.
Well, thank you.
That was writer and actor Wally Shawn, co-author and co-star of the film My Dinner with Andre. His latest play, Aunt Anne and Lemon, is published by Grove Press. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Mark Moss and Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.